needs to work as hard as humanly possible to deliver it. Trey, the friend Greg had met while living in Pasadena and recruited to Theranos, tapped Greg's foot. They glanced at each other knowingly. What Elizabeth had just said confirmed their armchair psychoanalysis of their boss. She saw herself as a world historical figure, a modern-day Marie Curie. 6 weeks later, they were back at the Fogarty Winery, this time to celebrate the Safeway Alliance. Standing on the deck of the open-air events house, Elizabeth harangued employees for 45 minutes as the fog rolled in, like General Patton addressing his troops before the Allied landings. The sweeping view before them was appropriate, she said, because Theranos was about to become Silicon Valley's dominant company. Toward the end, she boasted, "I'm not afraid of anything," adding after a brief pause, "except needles." By this point, Greg had become fully disillusioned and resolved to stick around only 2 more months until his stock options vested on the first anniversary of his hiring. He'd recently gone to a job fair at his alma mater, Georgia Tech, and had found himself unable to talk the company up to students who stopped by the Theranos booth. Instead, he'd focused his advice on the merits of a career in Silicon Valley. Part of the problem was that Elizabeth and Sonny seemed unable or unwilling to distinguish between a prototype and a finished product. The mini-lab Greg was helping to build was a prototype, nothing more. It needed to be tested thoroughly and fine-tuned, which would require time. A lot of time. Most companies went through 3 cycles of prototyping before they went to market with a product. But Sonny was already placing orders for components to build 100 mini-labs, based on a first, untested prototype. It was as if Boeing built 1 plane and, without doing a single flight test, told airline passengers, "Hop aboard." One of the difficulties that would need to be resolved through extensive testing was thermal. When you packed that many instruments into a small, enclosed space, you introduced unanticipated variations in temperature that could interfere with the chemistry and throw off the performance of the overall system. Sonny seemed to think that if you just put all the parts in a box and turned it on, it would work. If only it were that easy. At one point, he pulled Greg and an older engineer named Tom Brumette into the big glass conference room and questioned their passion. Greg prided himself on never losing his cool, but this time he did. He leaned menacingly over the conference table. His huge, muscular frame towered over Sonny. "God damn it, we are working our asses off," he growled. Sonny backed off and apologized. Sonny was a tyrant. He fired people so often that it gave rise to a little routine in the warehouse downstairs. John Fonzio, the affable supply chain manager, worked down there, and it had become the trusted place where employees came to vent or gossip. Every few days, Edgar Paz, the head of Theranos' security team, would come down with a mischievous look on his face, a badge hidden in his hand. At the sight of him, John and the logistics team would gather in excitement, knowing what was coming. As Paz drew closer, he would slowly spin the badge from its necklace and reveal the face on the front, eliciting gasps of surprise. It was Sonny's latest victim. John had become good friends with Greg, Jordan, Trey, and Ted. Together, the 5 of them formed a little island of sanity at the company. John was probably the only strategic supply chain manager in the Bay Area who worked just feet away from the cold roll-up door of the loading dock, but he liked it because it kept him away from Sonny's scrutiny and his obsessive focus on the number of hours people worked. Unfortunately, working in the warehouse is what eventually brought about John's own demise. One morning in February 2012, one of the receiving guys who worked there with him arrived at work in a shiny new Acura. He proudly showed it to John, who complimented him on it. The next day, though, the car had a big dent in it. someone had hit it in the office parking lot. John found the culprit by checking all the other cars in the lot for signs of a collision. It belonged to one of the Indian consultants Sonny had brought in to help with software development. John confronted the owner when he came outside for a smoke break with his friends. He denied it, even though John had used a tape measure to match the size of the dent on the Acura to the scrape on his car, a trick he'd learned from watching cops do it. John advised his warehouse colleague to report the accident to the police and show them the evidence. That's when the situation escalated. The Indian software consultants went upstairs to complain to Sonny, who came down in such a fury that his hands were visibly shaking.
"Oh, really? You want to be a cop?"
Sonny yelled at John, his voice dripping with sarcasm.
"Go be a cop!"
He then turned to one of the security guards who was standing nearby and, motioning toward John, told him,
"Get him out of here!"
After watching Edgar Paz playfully reveal the identity of scores of employees Sonny had fired over the previous year, it was John's turn to get the boot. His friend's firing didn't sit well with Greg and solidified his resolve to leave the company. A month later, a young engineer he worked with inadvertently fried some mini-lab electrical boards. Sonny summoned Greg and Tom Brumette to his office and angrily demanded that they tell him who was to blame. They refused, knowing full well that Sonny would fire the young man if they gave him his name. As it happened, Greg's stock options had just vested. Later in the day, he returned to Sonny's office and handed him his letter of resignation. Sonny calmly accepted it, but as soon as Greg left, he summoned Trey, Jordan, and Ted, one after the other, to gauge their intentions. All three assured him that Greg's decision didn't affect them, and that they remained committed to working at Theranos for the long haul, knowing that was what Sonny wanted to hear. Greg worked one last Saturday during his notice period. Sonny was grateful and invited him to a meeting Elizabeth was holding the following Monday in Newark, a small city directly across San Francisco Bay from Palo Alto. Theranos had just leased a huge manufacturing facility there to produce the mini-lab in large quantities. Elizabeth was unveiling the cavernous, empty space to employees. She caught sight of Greg in the audience as she spoke, and locked her gaze on him.
"If anyone here believes you are not working on the best thing humans have ever built, or if you're cynical, then you should leave," she said, reprising the themes of her Christmas speech. Then, while continuing to look directly at Greg, she singled out Trey, Jordan, and Ted for special praise. There were some 150 employees assembled, and she could have called out the names of any one of them, but she chose to commend the three people she knew were his friends. It was a final public rebuke.
In the months after Greg left, the revolving door at Theranos continued to swing at a furious pace. One of the more surreal incidents involved a burly software engineer named Del Barnwell. Big Del, as people called him, was a former Marine helicopter pilot. Sonny was on his case about not working long enough hours. He'd gone as far as to review security footage to track Big Dell's comings and goings and confronted him in a meeting in his office, claiming the tapes showed he worked only 8 hours a day.
"I'm going to fix you," Sonny told him, as if Dell were a broken toy.
But Big Dell didn't want to be fixed. Shortly after the meeting, he emailed his resignation notice to Elizabeth's assistant. He heard nothing back and dutifully worked the last 2 weeks of his notice period. Then, at 4 p.m. on a Friday, Big Dell picked up his belongings and walked toward the building's exit. Sonny and Elizabeth suddenly came running down the stairs behind him. He couldn't leave without signing a non-disclosure agreement, they said. Big Dell refused. He'd already signed a confidentiality agreement when he was hired, and besides, they'd had 2 weeks to schedule an exit interview with him. Now he was free to go as he pleased, and he damn well intended to. As he pulled out of the parking lot in his yellow Toyota FJ Cruiser,
Sonny sent a security guard after him to try to stop him. Big Dell ignored the guard and drove off. Sonny called the cops. 20 minutes later, a police cruiser quietly pulled up to the building with its lights off. A highly agitated Sonny told the officer that an employee had quit and departed with company property. When the officer asked what he'd taken, Sonny blurted out in his accented English, "He stole property in his mind." Chapter 9. The Wellness Play. Safeway's business was doing poorly. The supermarket chain had just announced a 6% drop in its profits for the last 3 months of 2011, a disappointing performance its longtime CEO Steve Bird was struggling to explain to the dozen analysts who now dialed into the company's quarterly earnings call. One of them, Ed Kelly from the Swiss bank Credit Suisse, was gently needling Bird for using stock buybacks to mask the bad results. By reducing the number of shares it had outstanding, buybacks could artificially raise a company's earnings per share, the headline number investors focused on, even if its actual earnings fell. It was an old trick that astute Wall Street analysts versed in corporate sleights of hand saw right through. Piqued, Bird said he disagreed. He was confident that Safeway's fortunes were about to improve, which would make purchasing its own shares a smart investment. To justify his optimism, he cited three initiatives the company was pursuing. The first two were shrugged off as old news by his hard-to-please audience. But the analyst's ears pricked up when he got to the third. "We're contemplating a significant... I'm just going to call it a wellness play," he said cryptically. It was the first time Bird had made any public mention of this. He didn't elaborate, but the message the analysts took away was that the stodgy 97-year-old grocery chain had a secret plan to jumpstart its stagnating business. Inside Safeway, this secret plan was codenamed Project T-Rex. It referred to none other than the company's partnership with Theranos, which by now, February 2012, was 2 years in the making. Bird had high hopes for the venture. He'd ordered the remodeling of more than half of Safeway's 1,700 stores to make room for upscale clinics, with deluxe carpeting, custom wood cabinetry, granite countertops, and flat-screen TVs. Per Theranos' instructions, they were to be called wellness centers and had to look better than a spa. Although Safeway was shouldering the entire cost of the $350 million renovation on its own, Bird expected it to more than pay for itself once the new clinic started offering the startup's novel blood tests. A few weeks after the earnings call, Bird and his executive team took a group of analysts on a tour of a Safeway store a few miles from his home in the scenic San Ramon Valley east of Oakland. The analysts were shown the store's new wellness center, but Bird remained evasive about what sort of service it was going to offer. Even the store's manager was in the dark. Theranos had insisted on absolute secrecy until the launch. There had been quite a few delays since the companies had first agreed to do business together. At one point, Elizabeth told Bird that the earthquake that struck eastern Japan in March 2011 was interfering with Theranos' ability to produce the cartridges for its devices. Some Safeway executives found the excuse far-fetched, but Bird accepted it at face value. He was starry-eyed about the young Stanford dropout and her revolutionary technology, which fit so perfectly with his passion for preventive health care. Elizabeth had a direct line to Bird and answered only to him. A war room had been set up in the Pleasanton headquarters, where a small group of Safeway executives, privy to Project T-Rex, met once a week to discuss its progress. Bird attended all the meetings, either in person or via conference call if he was traveling. When questions or issues came up that had to be taken back to Theranos, he would pipe up with what became a refrain, "I'll talk to Elizabeth about it."
Larie Renda, the executive who had started out at Safeway as a teenage bagger in 1974 and climbed the corporate ranks to become one of Byrd's top deputies, and other executives involved in the project were surprised by how much latitude he gave the young woman. He usually held his deputies and the company's business partners to firm deadlines, but he allowed Elizabeth to miss one after the other. Some of Byrd's colleagues knew he had two sons. They began to wonder if he saw in Elizabeth the daughter he'd never had. Whatever it was, he was in her thrall. After all the delays, the partnership seemed to finally be getting off the ground in the early months of 2012. As a beta run before a full launch, the companies had agreed that Theranos would take over the blood testing at an employee health clinic Safeway had opened on its corporate campus in Pleasanton. The clinic was part of Byrd's strategy to curb the supermarket operator's health care costs by encouraging its workers to take better care of themselves. It offered free checkups. Employees who scored well on them were entitled to discounts on their health plan premiums. Conveniently located next to the gym on the Safeway campus, it was staffed with a doctor and three nurse practitioners and featured five exam rooms. It also had a little lab. A new sign in the reception area read, "Testing done by Theranos." The employee clinic was part of Renda's portfolio. Among other responsibilities, she oversaw Safeway Health, the subsidiary Byrd had created to sell the retailer's health benefits expertise to other companies. Renda's husband had lost his battle with lung cancer since Elizabeth had first shown up in Pleasanton 2 years before, but she hoped Theranos's painless fingerstick tests would spare others the torment he'd endured getting repeatedly stuck with needles in the last months of his life. Renda had just hired Safeway's first chief medical officer. His name was Kent Bradley, and he came from the U.S. Army, where he had served for more than 17 years after attending West Point and the Armed Forces Medical School in Bethesda, Maryland. Bradley's last military assignment had been to run the European wing of TRICARE, the health insurance program for active and retired servicemen. Among other responsibilities, Renda gave the soft-spoken former Army doctor oversight of the campus clinic. Bradley had worked with a lot of sophisticated medical technologies in the Army, so he was curious to see the Theranos system in action. However, he was surprised to learn that Theranos wasn't planning on putting any of its devices in the Pleasanton clinic. Instead, it had stationed two phlebotomists there to draw blood, and the samples they collected were couriered across San Francisco Bay to Palo Alto for testing. He also noticed that the phlebotomists were drawing blood from every employee twice, once with a lancet applied to the index finger, and a second time the old-fashioned way with a hypodermic needle inserted in the arm. Why the need for venipunctures, the medical term for needle draws, if the Theranos fingerstick technology was fully developed and ready to be rolled out to consumers, he wondered. Bradley's suspicions were further aroused by the amount of time it took to get results back. His understanding had been that the tests were supposed to be quasi-instantaneous, but some Safeway employees were having to wait as long as 2 weeks to receive their results. And not every test was performed by Theranos itself. Even though the startup had never said anything about outsourcing some of the testing, Bradley discovered that it was farming out some tests to a big reference laboratory in Salt Lake City called ARUP. What really set off Bradley's alarm bells, though, was when some otherwise healthy employees started coming to him with concerns about abnormal test results. As a precaution, he sent them to get retested at a Quest or LabCorp location. Each time, the new set of tests came back normal, suggesting the Theranos results were off. Then one day, a senior Safeway executive got his PSA result back. The acronym stands for prostate-specific antigen, which is a protein produced by cells in the prostate gland. The higher the protein's concentration in a man's blood, the likelier he is to have prostate cancer.
The senior Safeway executive's result was very elevated, indicating he almost certainly had prostate cancer. But Bradley was skeptical. As he had done with the other employees, he sent his worried colleague to get retested at another lab, and, lo and behold, that result came back normal too. Bradley put together a detailed analysis of the discrepancies. Some of the differences between the Theranos values and the values from the other labs were disturbingly large. When the Theranos values did match those of the other labs, they tended to be for tests performed by ARUP. Bradley shared his concerns with Renda and with Brad Wolfson, the president of Safeway Health. Her faith already shaken by the delays of the past 2 years, Renda encouraged him to talk to Bird about them, which Bradley did. But Bird politely brushed him off, assuring the ex-army doctor that the Theranos technology had been vetted and was sound. The blood samples drawn from Safeway employees in Pleasanton were being couriered to a one-story building with a stone facade on East Meadow Circle in Palo Alto. Theranos had temporarily set up its fledgling lab there in the spring of 2012, while it moved the rest of its growing operations from Hillview Avenue to a larger building nearby, formerly occupied by Facebook. A few months earlier, the lab had obtained a certificate attesting that it was in compliance with CLIA, the federal law that governed clinical laboratories, but such certificates weren't difficult to obtain. Although the ultimate enforcer of CLIA was the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the federal agency delegated most routine lab inspections to states. In California, they were handled by the State Department of Health's Laboratory Field Services Division, which an audit had shown to be badly underfunded and struggling to fulfill its oversight responsibilities. Had Steve Bird been allowed inside the East Meadow Circle lab, a network of rooms located in the center of the low-slung building, he would have noticed that it didn't contain a single Theranos proprietary device. That's because the mini-lab was still under development and nowhere near ready for patient testing. What the lab did contain was more than a dozen commercial blood and body fluid analyzers made by companies such as Chicago-based Abbott Laboratories, Germany's Siemens, and Italy's Diasorin. The lab was run by an awkward pathologist named Arnold Gelb, who went by Arnie, and staffed with a handful of clinical laboratory scientists, or CLSs, lab technicians who are certified by the state to handle human samples. Although it made use of only commercial instruments at this juncture, there were still plenty of things that could and did go wrong. The main problem was the lab's dearth of experienced personnel. One of the CLSs, a fellow by the name of Kosal Lim, was so sloppy and poorly trained that one of his counterparts, Diana Dupuy, was convinced he was jeopardizing the accuracy of test results. Dupuy was from Houston and had trained at MD Anderson, the city's world-renowned cancer center. She'd spent most of her 7 years since becoming a CLS as a blood transfusion specialist, which had given her extensive exposure to CLIA regulations. She operated strictly by the book and didn't hesitate to report violations when she saw them. To Dupuy, Lim's blunders were inexcusable. They included ignoring manufacturers' instructions for how to handle reagents, putting expired reagents in the same refrigerator as current ones, running patient tests on lab equipment that hadn't been calibrated, improperly performing quality control runs on an analyzer, doing tasks he hadn't been trained to do, and contaminating a bottle of Wright's stain, a mixture of dyes used to differentiate blood cell types. Dupuy, who had a fiery streak, confronted Lim on several occasions, telling him at one point that she was going to become a laboratory inspector to root out bad lab technicians like him. When he proved unable to meet her standards, she began documenting his poor practices in regular emails she sent to Gelb and to Sonny, often attaching photos to prove her point. Dupuy also had concerns about the competence of the two phlebotomists Theranos had stationed in Pleasanton. Blood is typically spun down in a centrifuge before it's tested to separate its plasma from the patient's blood cells. The phlebotomists hadn't been trained to use the centrifuge they'd been given and didn't know how long or at what speed to spin down patients' blood. When they arrived in Palo Alto, the plasma samples were often polluted with particulate matter. She also discovered that many of the blood-drawing tubes Theranos was using were expired, making the anticoagulant in them ineffective and compromising the integrity of the specimens. Shortly after making one of her complaints, Dupuy was sent to Delaware to train on a new Siemens analyzer Theranos had purchased. When she returned from her trip a week later, she noticed that the lab was spotless. Sunny, who appeared to have been waiting for her, summoned her into a meeting room. In an intimidating tone, he informed her that he had taken a tour of the lab in her absence and found not a single one of her complaints to be justified. He then brought up the fact that she had allowed her boyfriend into the building to help her carry out her luggage on the day she'd flown to Delaware. It was a serious breach of the company's security policy, and he had decided to fire her for it, he said. After letting that sink in for a moment, he called Gelb in and asked him whether he valued Dupuy as a member of the lab and wanted to keep her on. Gelb said he did, at which point Sunny grudgingly reversed himself. Dupuy was still employed after all. Shaken, she went back to her desk in a daze. The next thing she knew, an employee from the IT department tapped her on the shoulder and asked her to step out into the hallway with him. He was trying to reestablish her company's cell phone connection and needed some information from her. Before changing his mind, Sunny had ordered it disconnected, along with her company email and her access to the corporate network. Someone as outspoken as Dupuy was bound not to last long at Theranos. 3 weeks later, on a Friday morning, Sunny returned to the East Meadow Circle building and fired her again, this time for good. She was immediately escorted out of the building without being given the chance to gather her personal belongings. The reason for her dismissal was that she had called attention to the fact that one of the lab's main vendors had put its purchase orders on hold because of unpaid bills. Upset about the way she was treated, Dupuy fired off an email to Sunny that weekend, insisting that she be allowed to retrieve her belongings, which in addition to lab books, included a makeup bag containing her eyeglasses and her California CLS license. The email, on which she copied Elizabeth, provided a searing indictment of Sunny's management style and of the state of the lab. "I was warned by more than 5 people that you are a loose cannon, and it all depends on your mood as to what will trigger you to explode. I was also told that any time someone deals with you, it's never a good outcome for that person. The CLIA lab is in trouble with Kosol running the show and no one watching him or Arnie. You have a mediocre lab director taking up for a subpar CLS for whatever reasons. I fully guarantee that Kosol will certainly make a huge mistake one day in the lab that will adversely affect patient results. I actually think he has already done this on several accounts, but has put the blame on the reagents. Just as you stated, everything he touches is a disaster. I am only hope that somehow I bring awareness to you that you have created a work environment where people hide things from you out of fear. You cannot run a company through fear and intimidation. It will only work for a period of time before it collapses." Sunny agreed to have someone meet her in front of the East Meadow Circle building to return her belongings, but warned her that she would be hearing from the company's lawyers. Over the next several days, Dupuy received a series of sternly worded emails from David Doyle, the Theranos senior counsel, demanding that she sign a declaration pledging to return to Theranos or permanently destroy any materials from her employment at the company and abide by her confidentiality obligations. Dupuy initially refused and hired an Oakland attorney to threaten the company with a wrongful termination lawsuit, but her lawyer advised her to back down and to sign the document once Theranos brought in a high-powered attorney from Wilson Sonsini.
Going up against Silicon Valley's premier law firm was a losing battle, he told her. She reluctantly followed his advice. Safeway, of course, had no knowledge of any of this. It continued to let Theranos handle the blood testing at its Pleasanton clinic throughout 2012 and into 2013. It also began hiring phlebotomists to staff the wellness centers it had built in dozens of its stores in Northern California. But as the months went by, Theranos continued to push back the date for a launch. Bird was asked about the status of Safeway's mysterious wellness play on its first quarter earnings call in late April 2012. He replied that it wasn't yet ready for prime time, but that when the company did unveil it, it would have a material impact on its financial results. In the next earnings call in July, he volunteered that it would play out in all likelihood in the fourth quarter. However, the fourth quarter came and went without a launch. By this point, some Safeway executives were getting angry. They were being denied their bonuses because the company was missing its financial targets, which had factored in the anticipated extra revenues and profits from the Theranos partnership. Matt O'Rell, an executive in Safeway's finance department, had been tasked with coming up with revenue projections for the wellness centers. Working from the aggressive assumption that each of them would attract an average of 50 patients per day, he had forecast $250 million in extra revenue per year. Not only had that revenue failed to materialize, Safeway had spent $100 million more than that just to build the centers. While they sat idle, the wellness centers occupied valuable real estate inside the stores that could have been put to other, profitable uses. Fed up with waiting, Renda and Bradley put together various ideas for how the space could be utilized. One of them was to staff the centers with nutritionists who would offer dietary advice. Another was to turn them into full-fledged medical clinics run by nurse practitioners. Yet another was to offer telemedicine services. They lobbied Bird to let them implement these plans, but after discussing the matter with Elizabeth, he turned them down. She didn't want to surrender the space, he said. Behind the scenes, Safeway's board of directors was losing patience. After 20 years in the job, it was clear that Bird had lost the confidence of Wall Street. His first decade as CEO had been a big success and featured a sharp rise in Safeway's stock price. But in recent years, his passion for health and wellness had made him lose sight of what remained at the heart of the company, the unglamorous business of selling groceries. The large investment made in the wellness centers and the endless delays in bringing it to fruition were the last straw. Shortly after the stock market closed, on January 2, 2013, Safeway put out a press release announcing that Bird would retire the following May after the company's annual shareholder meeting. The news was presented as a voluntary decision, but Renda and other executives suspected that the board had asked him to step down. Even on his way out, Bird remained upbeat about the prospects for the still-secret Theranos partnership. Among a list of his achievements as CEO, the press release quoted him as saying that Safeway would soon be rolling out a wellness initiative that has the potential to transform the company. After Bird's departure, the communication channel to Elizabeth was lost. Anyone from Safeway who wanted to talk to Theranos had to go through Sonny or the frat pack. Sonny acted put off whenever Safeway executives asked for status updates, as if his time was too precious to waste, and they had no idea what it took to produce an innovation of this magnitude. His arrogance was infuriating. And yet, Safeway was still hesitant to walk away from the partnership. What if the Theranos technology did turn out to be game-changing? It might spend the next decade regretting passing up on it. The fear of missing out was a powerful deterrent. As for Bird, it was clear he hadn't been ready to retire. Just 3 months after leaving the supermarket chain, he founded a consulting firm to advise companies on how to reduce their healthcare costs.
He called it Bird Health. In his new role as a fellow health startup founder, he tried to get back in touch with Elizabeth, but she no longer returned his calls.
Chapter 10. Who is LTC Shoemaker?
Lieutenant Colonel David Shoemaker had been politely listening to the confident young woman seated at the head of the conference table explain how her company intended to operate when, 15 minutes in, he couldn't hold his tongue anymore.
"Your regulatory structure is not going to fly," he said, interrupting her.
Elizabeth shot an annoyed look at the bespectacled officer in army fatigues as he enumerated the various regulations he thought the approach she'd described fell afoul of. This was not what she wanted to hear. Shoemaker and the little military delegation he was leading had been invited to Palo Alto on this morning in November 2011 to bless Theranos' plans to deploy its devices in the Afghan war theater, not to raise objections about its regulatory strategy. The idea of using Theranos devices on the battlefield had germinated the previous August when Elizabeth had met James Mattis, head of the U.S. Central Command, at the Marines Memorial Club in San Francisco. Elizabeth's impromptu pitch about how her novel way of testing blood from just a finger prick could help diagnose and treat wounded soldiers faster and potentially save lives had found a receptive audience in the four-star general. Jim Mad Dog Mattis was fiercely protective of his troops, which made him one of the most popular commanders in the U.S. military. The hard-charging general was open to pursuing any technology that might keep his men safer as they fought the Taliban in the interminable, atrocity-marred war in Afghanistan. After meeting Elizabeth, he'd asked subordinates at CENTCOM to set up a live field test of the Theranos device. Under military rules, such requests had to be routed through the Army's medical department at Fort Detrick in Maryland, where they usually landed on the desk of Lieutenant Colonel Shoemaker. As deputy director for the Division of Regulated Activities and Compliance, Shoemaker's job was to ensure that the Army abided by all laws and regulations when it experimented with medical devices. Shoemaker wasn't your average military bureaucrat. He had a PhD in microbiology and had spent years doing medical research on vaccines for meningitis and tularemia, a dangerous bacterium found in cottontail rabbits that was weaponized by the United States and the Soviet Union during the Cold War. He'd also been the first Army officer to complete a one-year fellowship at the Food and Drug Administration, making him the Army's resident expert on FDA regulations. With his genial smile and his Southern Ohio drawl, Shoemaker had a calm, self-effacing manner about him, but he could be direct with people when he needed to be. Theranos's strategy, which envisioned bypassing the FDA altogether, was a non-starter, he warned Elizabeth, especially if she planned to roll out her devices nationwide by the following spring, as she had asserted to him. There was no way the agency would allow her to do that without going through its review process, he told her. Elizabeth disagreed forcefully, citing advice Theranos had received from its lawyers. She was so defensive and obstinate that Shoemaker quickly realized that prolonging the argument would be a waste of time. She clearly didn't want to hear anything that contradicted her point of view. As he looked around the table, he noted that she had brought no regulatory affairs expert to the meeting. He suspected the company didn't even employ one. If he was right about that, it was an incredibly naive way of operating. Healthcare was the most highly regulated industry in the country, and for good reason. The lives of patients were at stake. Shoemaker told Elizabeth she would need to get something in writing from the FDA supporting her position if she wanted him to greenlight the use of her machines on Army personnel. Her face conveyed deep displeasure. She resumed her presentation, but gave Shoemaker the cold shoulder for the rest of the day. In his 18-year career in the Army, Shoemaker had come across a lot of people
who seemed to think the military was exempt from civilian regulations and free to conduct medical research as it pleased. That was simply not the case, though this wasn't to say it hadn't happened in the past. The Pentagon tested mustard gas on American soldiers during World War II and Agent Orange on prisoners in the 1960s. But the days of unsupervised, freewheeling medical experimentation by the military were long gone. During the Serbian conflict in the 1990s, for instance, the Pentagon made sure to get the FDA's assent before offering troops deployed in the Balkans an experimental vaccine against tick-borne encephalitis, and only soldiers who wished to receive the vaccine were given it. Similarly, the Army worked closely with the agency to make an investigational vaccine against botulinum toxin available to soldiers in Iraq in 2003. At the time, concerns were high that Saddam Hussein had stockpiled the lethal biological agent, and the promising vaccine, which had been developed by researchers at Fort Detrick, hadn't yet been approved by the FDA. In both instances, the Army consulted an Institutional Review Board, or IRB, a committee within the military that monitors medical research to ensure that it is conducted safely and ethically. If the IRB deems that a proposed study doesn't pose significant risks, the FDA will usually allow it to go forward, provided it's carried out under a strict protocol the committee has reviewed and approved. What was valid for vaccines was also valid for medical devices. If Theranos wanted to try out its blood testing machines on troops in Afghanistan, Shoemaker felt certain that it would need to put together an IRB-approved study protocol. But since Elizabeth had been so adamant, and he was also getting second-guessed by CENTCOM, he decided to bring in Jeremiah Kelly, an Army lawyer who'd previously worked at the FDA. He scheduled another meeting with Elizabeth so Kelly could hear from her directly and provide a second opinion. They agreed to meet at 3:30 p.m. on December 9, 2011, at the Washington, D.C. offices of Theranos' law firm, Zuckerman Spader. Elizabeth came to the meeting alone with a single-page document outlining the same regulatory approach Shoemaker had heard her present a few weeks before in Palo Alto. He had to give it to her. The structure she laid out was creative. One might even call it sneaky. The document explained that Theranos' devices were merely remote sample processing units. The real work of blood analysis would take place in the company's lab in Palo Alto, where computers would analyze the data the devices transmitted to it, and qualified laboratory personnel would review and interpret the results. Hence, only the Palo Alto lab needed to be certified. The devices themselves were akin to dumb fax machines and exempt from regulatory oversight. There was a second wrinkle Shoemaker found equally hard to swallow. Theranos maintained that the blood tests its devices performed were laboratory-developed tests and therefore beyond the FDA's purview. The Theranos position, then, was that a CLIA certificate for its Palo Alto lab was sufficient for it to deploy and use its devices anywhere. This was a clever theory, but Shoemaker didn't buy it. And neither did Kelly. The Theranos devices were more than just dumb fax machines. They were blood analyzers, and like all other blood analyzers on the market, they would eventually need to be reviewed and approved by the FDA. Until then, Theranos would need to consult with an institutional review board and come up with a study protocol that the agency could live with. It was a process that typically took 6 to 9 months. Elizabeth continued to disagree despite the Army lawyer's presence. Her body language wasn't as hostile as it had been in Palo Alto, and she was more willing to engage in a discussion, but they remained at an impasse. What was strange was that no one from Zuckerman Spader was there with her in the room. Shoemaker had expected her to show up accompanied by several of the firm's partners, but there she was on her own. She continued to invoke the firm's legal advice, but no one from the firm was present to attest to it. The meeting ended with Shoemaker reiterating that he would need to see something in writing from the FDA
backing up Theranos' regulatory stance before he signed off on any experiment in Afghanistan. Elizabeth agreed to get such a letter. She acted as if it was a formality. Shoemaker very much doubted so, but at least things were now clear. The ball was in Theranos' court. Shoemaker didn't hear anything more about the matter until the late spring of 2012, when he started receiving queries from CENTCOM again. He couldn't help but be annoyed. Not only had Theranos failed to produce the letter he'd asked for, the company had gone completely silent since he and Kelly had traveled to Washington to meet Elizabeth in December. With the approval of his boss, he decided to make contact with the FDA himself. On the morning of June 14, 2012, he sent an email to Sally Hoivat, the head of the agency's microbiology devices division. The two had worked together during Shoemaker's FDA fellowship in 2003 and had just run into each other at a conference the previous week. Shoemaker described to Hoivat the Theranos situation and, calling the company's regulatory approach quite novel, requested the agency's guidance on it. Although he didn't intend his email as anything more than an informal request for advice, it set off a sequence of events that would have made him think twice about sending it if he could have foreseen them. Hoivat forwarded the query to five of her colleagues, including Alberto Gutierrez, the director of the FDA's Office of In Vitro Diagnostics and Radiological Health. Gutierrez, who had a PhD in chemistry from Princeton, happened to have spent a not insignificant portion of his 20-year career at the agency pondering the questions of laboratory-developed tests. The FDA had long considered it within its power to regulate LDTs, as laboratory-developed tests were known. However, in practice, it had not done so because back in 1976, when the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act was amended to expand the agency's authority from drugs to medical devices, LDTs weren't common. They were only made by local laboratories occasionally when an unusual medical case required it. That changed in the 1990s, when laboratories started to make more complex tests for mass use, including genetic tests. By the FDA's own reckoning, scores of flawed and unreliable tests had since been marketed for conditions ranging from whooping cough and Lyme disease to various types of cancers, resulting in untold harm to patients. There was a growing consensus within the agency that it needed to start policing this part of the lab business, and the biggest proponent of that view was Gutierrez. When he saw the email Hoivat forwarded to him from Shoemaker, Gutierrez shook his head in disbelief. The approach it described was exactly the type of regulatory end run around the FDA that he wanted to put a stop to. Gutierrez's view that it was the FDA, not the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, that should regulate LDTs did not mean he didn't get along with his colleagues at CMS. To the contrary, they had a good working relationship and often communicated across agency lines to try to bridge the regulatory gap spawned by outdated statutes. Gutierrez forwarded the Shoemaker email to Judith Yost and Penny Keller, two members of CMS's Lab Oversight Division, adding a note at the top. How about this one? Would CMS consider this an LDT? I have a hard time seeing that we would exercise enforcement discretion on this one. Alberto. After some back and forth, Gutierrez, Yost, and Keller all reached the same conclusion. The Theranos model didn't comply with federal regulations. Yost and Keller decided it wouldn't hurt to send someone to Palo Alto to see what exactly this company that none of them had heard of before was up to, and to correct its misconceptions. The job fell to Gary Yamamoto, a veteran field inspector in CMS's regional office in San Francisco. 2 months later, on August 13, 2012, Yamamoto arrived unannounced at Theranos' offices in Palo Alto. By then, the company had completed its move to the old Facebook building, located at 1601 South California Avenue, less than a mile from its former home on Hillview Avenue.
Sonny and Elizabeth ushered Yamamoto into a conference room. When he explained that his agency had received a complaint about Theranos and that he was there to look into it, he was surprised to learn that they knew where and who it came from. Someone had apparently tipped them off about Shoemaker's email to the FDA. Elizabeth was not pleased, a sentiment made clear by the scowl on her face. She and Sonny professed not to know what Shoemaker had been talking about in his email. Yes, Elizabeth had met with the army officer, but she had never told him Theranos intended to deploy its blood testing machines far and wide under the cover of a single CLIA certificate. Why then had Theranos applied for a CLIA certificate? Yamamoto asked. Sonny responded that the company wanted to learn about how labs worked, and what better way to do that than to operate one itself? Yamamoto found that answer fishy and borderline nonsensical. He asked to see their lab. They couldn't deny him access the way they had to Kevin Hunter. This was the representative of a federal regulatory agency, not some private lab consultant they could thumb their noses at. So Sonny reluctantly took the inspector to a room on the second floor of the new building. After Dupuis's firing, Theranos had moved the lab there from its temporary East Meadow Circle location. What Yamamoto found in the room didn't impress him, but didn't raise any big concerns either. It was a small space with a couple of people in white lab coats and a smattering of commercial diagnostic instruments that were sitting idle. It looked like any other lab. No sign of any special or novel blood testing technology. When he pointed this out, Sonny said the Theranos devices were still under development, and the company had no plans to deploy them without FDA clearance, flatly contradicting what Elizabeth had told Shoemaker on not one but two occasions. Yamamoto wasn't sure what to believe. Why would the army officer have made all that stuff up? There were no clear violations he could point to about the way Theranos was currently operating, however, so he let Sonny off with a long lecture about lab regulations. He made sure to emphasize that the scenario Shoemaker had described in his email to Sally Hoivat, experimental blood analyzers operated remotely from one CLIA-certified mother base, was out of the question. If Theranos intended to eventually roll its devices out to other locations, those places would need CLIA certificates too. Either that, or better yet, the devices themselves would need to be approved by the FDA. Elizabeth wasn't one to sit still and quietly take it when she felt her company was under attack. In a blistering email to General Mattis, she hit back against the person who had dared to put hurdles in her way. Shoemaker, she wrote, had communicated blatantly false information to the FDA and CMS about Theranos. She went on to heap several paragraphs of scorn on the lieutenant colonel and listed seven inaccurate statements he had allegedly made to the agencies, compiled with assistance from our counsel. Her email closed with a request. We are taking swift action to correct these misleading statements. I would very much appreciate your help in getting this information corrected with the regulatory agencies. LTC Shoemaker communicated to the FDA that he was giving them a heads-up about what Theranos was up to and provided the agency with incorrect information that makes us appear to be in violation of the law. Since this information came from within DOD, it will be invaluable if this information is formally corrected by the right people in DOD. Thank you for your thoughts, and as always, for your time. With my best regards, Elizabeth. When he read Elizabeth's email a few hours later, Mattis was furious. He forwarded it to Colonel Aaron Edgar, CENTCOM's command surgeon, and the aide-de-camp he'd put in charge of making the Theranos field test happen, with a note that conveyed his anger. Aaron, who is LTC Shoemaker and what is going on here? I have tried to get this device tested in theater ASAP, legally and ethically, and I need to know, did this visit happen as related below, and how do we overcome this new obstacle? Bottom line, I need ground truth for the accuracy of the statements below. If I need to see LTC Shoemaker and LTC Man so they can explain how I am pushing for something unethical or illegal, please set up a time for them to meet with me in Tampa when I return to the States. I am going to be delayed in theater past my original return date. Thanks, M. The CMS inspector's surprise visit had put Elizabeth on the war path. In a phone call to Colonel Edgar, she threatened to sue Shoemaker. Edgar relayed her threat to his Fort Detrick colleague, along with news of the inspection. He also forwarded to Shoemaker Elizabeth's email to Mattis and Mattis's reaction to it. When he read the email string, Shoemaker blanched. Mattis was one of the most powerful and fearsome people in the military. The blunt-spoken general had once famously told Marines stationed in Iraq, "Be polite, be professional, but have a plan to kill everybody you meet." This was not a guy you wanted to get on the wrong side of if you were a lower-ranking army officer. Shoemaker also felt genuinely bad that his actions had led to an inspection of the company. He was well placed to know how unpleasant such visits could be. His previous assignment had been at the Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, where he'd taken over as director of BioSurety, the department responsible for securing biothreat agents used in Army research, 2 weeks before Bruce Ivins killed himself in July 2008. The suicide had led to the disclosure that Ivins, an institute researcher, was the likely perpetrator of the 2001 anthrax attacks, and to an avalanche of inspections from an alphabet soup of government agencies that had continued unabated for 2 years. Shoemaker had been the officer on the receiving end of every single one of them. With Colonel Edgar's encouragement, he tried to defuse the situation by emailing CMS officials that he had never meant to imply that Theranos had already implemented the regulatory strategy he'd described, merely that it was considering it. He also expressed surprise that the agency had told Theranos he was the one who requested the inspection. The response he got brought another surprise. CMS had told Theranos no such thing. The company already had a copy of his correspondence with the FDA when the inspector arrived. When he confronted Colonel Edgar with that information, Edgar sheepishly admitted that he had been the one who'd shared his email to Sally Hoivat with Elizabeth in what he described as an oversight. He apologized and invited Shoemaker to come to CENTCOM headquarters in Tampa, Florida the following week to walk Mattis through the regulatory issues. Shoemaker was nervous about meeting the general face to face, but he accepted the invitation. He reached out to Alberto Gutierrez to see if he could join him on the trip, figuring his opinion would carry more weight if it was supported by someone high up in the FDA. Although it was on short notice, Gutierrez agreed to come along. At 3 p.m. sharp on August 23, 2012, Colonel Edgar escorted the two men into Mattis's office on MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa. The 61-year-old general was an intimidating figure in person, muscular and broad-shouldered, with dark circles under his eyes that suggested a man who didn't bother much with sleep. His office was decorated with the mementos of a long military career. Amid the flags, plaques, and coins, Shoemaker's eyes rested briefly on a set of magnificent swords displayed in a glass cabinet. As they sat down in a wood-paneled conference room off to one side of the office, Mattis cut to the chase. "Guys, I've been trying to get this thing deployed for a year now. What's going on?" Shoemaker had gone over everything again with Gutierrez and felt confident he was on solid ground. He spoke first, giving a brief overview of the issues raised by an in-theater test of the Theranos technology. Gutierrez took over from there and told the general his army colleague was correct in his interpretation of the law. The Theranos device was very much subject to regulation by the FDA. And since the agency hadn't yet reviewed and approved it for commercial use, it could only be tested on human subjects under strict conditions set by an institutional review board. One of those conditions was that the test subjects give their informed consent, something that was notoriously hard to obtain in a war zone. Mattis was reluctant to give up. He wanted to know.